Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Apogee Instruments, a Cache Valley company building precision sensors that support global research in sustainable food production, renewable energy, and climate change.
You're listening to the Going Native segment of The Zesty Garden. Barney Barnett is co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard and is in the studio with me. And our next plant is actually one of my favorite in my yard. It's the Baptisia, or also known as an indigo. And there's several different cultivars. The one I've got is yellow. And it looks growing like a lupin, but it comes back every year. And just these beautiful kind of popcorn-shaped, very yellow blossoms. But then once the blossoms are done, I've got these seed heads that are these little, well, they're about 3/4 of an inch across, little globes that I just like to leave on.
Baptisia is a great plant. It is a North American native, primarily east, southeast and central North America is where we'd find it. I'm not sure of any native species here out west where we are, but these plants, even though they're from east of the Rockies, primarily they seem to be adaptable for us just fine out here, even relatively drought tolerant, maybe not completely, but relatively drought tolerant.
And mine happens to be, I've got it around, it's by a tree just outside of my grass area, so it's getting more water than what Mother Nature is providing. How would it do with less water?
It will do fine with less water, but not completely xeric or drought tolerant. It's
okay.
Going to need some supplemental irrigation each season or periodically, so it's not going to be completely xeric, but it's a pretty tough plant once established. It's interesting in that it'll almost have a shrub-like appearance, 2 or 3 feet tall, 2 or 3 feet wide once established, and must have a mechanism of establishing a really good deep root system, which then gives it a measure of drought tolerance.
Now, I've got one. It's in full sun pretty much, and another one that's in half sun. So it's getting, it's pretty much shaded from 1 o'clock on, and I'm not getting any blossoms on it. Is it because it's in too much shade?
That
foliage looks fine.
That would probably be the case. They are tolerant of part shade, not of deep shade. Sun, part sun would be their best place. Yet you get sun till one, I would almost think that would be enough, but I'm not sure.
I'm going to cut that branch out that's causing that much shade anyway.
Okay.
So, and we'll see what happens
good
with it.
Good for you. Typically, the species is Australis, which is a blue flowering form. There's another species called Alba. The one you have, you say, is a yellow, and you gave it a funny name.
Yeah, I think it's called Screamin' Wild Indigo.
Okay.
Because when I looked at the name, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. So.
But Baptisia has become popular in the industry, in gardens, and there have been hybridizers doing things with the blue and with the yellow and with the white species, the straight species, and doing hybridizing and coming up with some different colors, different sizes even, more compact ones for people who would like something a little bit more compact. This plant blooms early, meaning when I say early, I'm saying late spring, early summer. So for a plant that's 2 feet tall and 2 feet wide potentially, that's pretty early blooming for a plant that size.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great to have that early color on a large plant, and then the foliage is lovely afterwards, and as you mentioned, the seed head is interesting. It's just a nice plant, and it's tidy. It never gets out of control. I don't think I've ever seen a seedling from it, even though seed is its natural way of propagating itself. I don't know that I've ever seen a seedling that's been thrown adjacent to it. It's just a nice, tidy plant.
I have my Baptisia next to a purple salvia.
Okay.
And it's just gorgeous to have that yellow and purple right there together.
Yeah, that would be. With that yellow. Yeah, because they're blooming late spring, early summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the salvia will repeat, whereas the baptisia won't.
As far as what else you would plant next to it, what would you do?
Well, first I determine which color of bloom I've got, if it's the yellow like the one you've got, or if it's a blue form, then you say, what contrast do I want? So then you would determine the height of your, in addition to your flower color contrast, the height you want. Often I like to do things that are what's called half high. And so if I have a plant, let's say my baptisia is a yellow one that is 2 to 3 feet tall, I might want something next to it that's quote unquote half high. So that might be 18 inches tall so that I've got that contrast then as far as size, and then choose color wise.
And it sounds like from the water requirements, this may not be a plant that you would want to grow in St. George.
I would think that that's true unless you tucked it in a little shade and made sure that you had decent irrigation. That would be a grand experiment.
And how cold hardy?
3, 4.
Okay.
So plenty cold hardy.
Mine's zone 4 where I am, so great. Well, this is the baptisia, also known as indigo. We've been talking about it here on the Going Native segment of the Zesty Garden with Barney Barnett, who's co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard.
So, Brian, before we say goodbye, look for some chocolate-colored ones. So somehow these breeders are breeding this blue and this yellow, and I don't know how blue and yellow ends up being chocolate, but there's one called Chocolate Decadence. So maybe in the springtime, look for Chocolate Decadence Baptisia.
Great. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me in the studio today is Dr. Nick Wyman. He is Oregon State University's Extension Orchard Crop Specialist and is the leading Western expert on brown marmorated stink bug. He was recently in Utah as part of the Utah State University Biology Department seminar series. Brown marmorated stink bug is an invasive insect that is native to Asia and is a severe threat to fruits, vegetables, and some field crops. It was first detected in Utah in 2012 and has since been collected in Utah, Salt Lake, Davis, and Weber counties. Dr. Wyman, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks very much.
Brown marmorated stink bug is becoming a terrible pest. I was reading online about what it was doing in Pennsylvania, for instance, and now it's all up and down the eastern seaboard. When did it first show up in Oregon?
It was first found in 2004, and just by accident, it was found in a beetle trap. So we weren't looking for it. So we don't actually know how long it has been there, but first showed up on the East Coast in 1996.
And this is a voracious pest. Unlike so many insects that tend to specialize, this one seems to have a broad host range.
Yeah, that's really the problem with it, is that it spans so many different environment types, from urban environments where it does really well on ornamental species to natural environments where it can be found on native hardwood species primarily, and then, of course, the agricultural environment.
I mean, even to the point where not only, because it has piercing sucking mouth parts, and so it can pierce into, like apples, but you can eat the bark of younger trees.
Yeah, so it's really versatile insect. It can feed on vegetative structures and also fruits and nuts and seeds, even on grains.
So what kind of damage do you normally see? How do you know you have brown marmorated stink bug in your orchard or your yard?
Well, the damage really manifests itself differently depending on what stage of growth the host plant is in. And so it's very difficult to diagnose vegetative damage. But when there's feeding on, say, apples or other pome fruits, it really doesn't, unless they're feeding early, then you get development of cells around the dead tissues, and that causes some deformation of the fruit, and that's very apparent. But if they feed late in the season, that doesn't happen, and you don't see much indication of the damage unless you actually cut into the fruit. So a big problem has been that fruit that looks pretty good goes into storage, and after storage, it just gets worse over time. And so then you get these really bad corking damage is what we call it, where you get these pithy cells that are, you know, discolored beneath the surface of the fruit.
And I was reading, okay, so it feeds on leaves, seeds, fruits, and even through the bark, tree fruits, vegetables, grapes. It can contaminate hay or silage. And where's the end to this insect?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how it spans all these different industries. I don't think there are many pests that are, you know, to that level of affecting so many different crops. And it's the urban issues are non-trivial either. I mean, a lot of homeowners are affected by this pest, and it's become really a real estate issue as well. So,
does it eventually kill the host plant?
It can. It can kill young plants, but there are a lot of things we don't understand. There's potential that it's moving some plant pathogens around as well, so it could contribute to poor plant health that way.
Would you put this in one of your top three most destructive insects in the country that we should be concerned about right now?
Absolutely, yeah. It's really bad.
So what does it look like?
The bug itself is sort of shield-shaped. It's like a typical stink bug. It's
brown. Brown, obviously.
Yeah.
Marmorated, meaning marbled.
Exactly. So it's often described as brown, but actually if you flip them over and look at the underside, you might see bright coloration from red to yellow to green even. And there are five immature life stages, and they look quite different from the adults. The really early life stages look a little bit like ticks, and you'll see them crawling on the plant. So they do more vegetative feeding, but they can also damage the crop itself too.
What is it that looks like there's white along the edges of the stink bug?
Well, they do have sort of a banding pattern on the abdomen. Is that what you're...
Yeah. And then on the antenna, one of the segments has a white...
Yeah, actually, antenna. If you're looking for a distinguishing character, the antennae are the place to look. So they have like a charcoal-colored antenna with white bands, two white bands on the antenna.
So they're, what, about a 3/4 inch?
Yeah.
And about a 1/2 inch wide, approximately. Where will you see them? Are they usually on the underside of leaves?
Well, it really depends on the time of year. So the adults are the overwintering stage, and they are the ones that cause the most urban issues when they come to human structures in the fall in mass numbers. So in the fall, you might see them on the side of your house.
Is this heat related?
It is heat. It's not well understood. They're looking for protected overwintering sites, which they find in houses, and they work their ways through little cracks, and they like unfinished spaces.
Sounds like box elder bugs.
Very, very similar to box elder bugs. In fact, in like the Portland area, where we have the most severe urban issues in the state, a lot of people that have had box elder bug problems for years are now seeing gradual displacement by the stink bugs. So they do occupy a similar niche.
And this is a worse pest because not only is it destroying the foliage and plants, but it stinks. It has a smell that it gives off if it's disturbed.
Yes, that's true. So they're like little chemical factories, and we've looked at what they're producing, and we've found, I think, over 40 different compounds. And they have different functions, these compounds. A lot of them are, you know, defensive to deter predators, but others are antimicrobial, so they protect them from fungi and other things that that are always attacking insects. And others are actually insecticides that they produce. So if you collect a bunch of brown marmorated stink bugs and you put them in a poorly ventilated container, they will actually kill themselves.
Oh, so does this chemical factory then make them more resistant to other chemicals that could kill them if they're if they're not concentrated?
It definitely makes them more resistant to fungal pathogens, which in insect management, sometimes we like to use those as a sort of a soft management tactic.
So in a climate like northern Utah, for instance, how many generations of these are we going to see in a year?
Well, that's a really good question. We don't know the answer to that. In Oregon, we have found that there are two generations, and part of it is when do they get started in the spring, and there appear to be some photoperiod triggers, and particularly we think 14 hours of daylight is what triggers them to begin sexual maturation and start moving away from their overwintering sites and reproducing. But we're quite a bit further north than Utah, so I think you will have less days over 14 hours than we do. I don't know if that's enough to factor in. So I think it's going to take some experimentation to determine how many generations you're going to get here.
Now, Oregon has 99% of the hazelnut crop in the United States.
Yes.
And hazelnuts seem to be a delicacy for the brown marmorated stink bug. So I'm wondering what other nut pests or what other nut trees are they attracted to?
Well, that's a great question. We don't know the answer to that. So on the East Coast, we have mostly seen problems with palm fruits and some on berries.
So like apples and
apples
pears.
Not so much pears, but mostly apples. And then a little bit on wine grapes, and berry crops can also be at risk. And as this pest moves into the West Coast, we're going to see a lot greater diversity of crops affected. I should have mentioned vegetables. Vegetables have been a big deal on the East Coast.
Yeah, tomatoes, corn,
yeah.
Peppers.
And even agronomic crops like soybean. So they've had big problems with the stink bug. But I think Oregon has the distinction of being the first state to have a nut crop affected. But we certainly think that they will enjoy almonds, pistachios, pecans, other nuts that are grown in to the south of us in California.
I was going to say, as it heads south, the almond crop could be devastated.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that could be massive economic effects. And so we're really concerned because California has been seeing a major increase in the pest as well.
And I would imagine that with drought, that's going to stress the tree and just cause more issues than it normally would have anyway.
Yeah, that's probably the case, yeah.
So with the hazelnut crop, you went through a period of time in Oregon where the crop was affected by a blight. There's now a resistant, couple of resistant varieties to that.
Correct.
How is the stink bug affecting the crop now?
Well, I think people are just starting to realize that they're getting damage. And I heard from some of the processors this year that they had a lot of damage. And so it's sort of, we've sort of anticipated that this was coming, and we've been doing some research on, you know, how to distinguish the characteristics of stink bug feeding on the nuts themselves, and done a lot of outreach to our growers just to make sure they know what they're looking for and what's going on. And I think, you know, we do a lot of that in IPM, you know, a lot of warning, and people get sort of desensitized after a while. But once they start finding it on their farm, it becomes very real to them. So,
and IPM is integrated pest management.
Yes.
Using all different ways of control, not just one.
Exactly, yeah.
So how does the damage show up on a nut crop? Because usually you'd think, oh, nuts, they're kind of hard, but initially there's a green stage. Is that where they're attacking the nuts?
Well, if they do, then they can cause the kernel itself to not form. And so that's what we call a blank. So you have a shell, but there's no kernel inside. And that's very easy for the processors to deal with because they essentially float out. And they can get rid of those very easily. The problem is the late season damage when the bug is actually feeding through the shell into the kernel inside, and they're damaging the kernel itself.
How is it getting through a hard shell?
They're quite amazing. They have little teeth on their mouth parts, and they're very agile. They can work their mouth parts between cells, between cell walls. It's it's pretty amazing. But that is the real issue for the processors, because they take a sample at the processor of each grower's nuts. So they crack the shells and then they assess the damage based off of that sample. But a lot of these nuts are going for the in-shell market, so they don't really know what's in those nuts until they're cracked open. So it's a real issue for the Oregon and hazelnut industry, which were regarded as producing one of the highest quality hazelnut crops in the world. But the problem is that it's hard to detect this damage that's inside the shell.
So are hazelnuts grown outside of the U.S. as well?
Yeah, the main producer in the world is Turkey, followed by Italy.
And do they? What are they doing? Do they have brown marmorated stink bugs in their areas?
I don't think they do in Turkey, but Europe now has a problem with brown marmorated stink bug, and it started showing up there about the same time as it did in Oregon.
So I would imagine it's been around in its native habitat for a long time. What all of a sudden caused it to start expanding? Is that part of global warming? Where do we really even know?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I think we've had pressure from this pest for a long time. And I think maybe it was here before, for a while before it was really detected. But in Asia, it is regarded as a periodic pest. So once in a while, it flares up. However, there are natural enemies that keep it in check in Asia. And one of the most important ones is a small parasitoid wasp that attacks the eggs called Trisulcus japonicus. And the U.S. has imported that wasp into quarantine facilities all around the country. And we have one in Oregon State University, and we've been evaluating potential non-target effects of this wasp if it were to be released.
And what are their preliminary results showing?
Well, it's not in the laboratory where these tests take place. Some of the tests that they do are very challenging for the wasp. So all this wasp wants to do is just lay its eggs in a stink bug egg. And so when you present it with the eggs of another stink bug species and it doesn't have a choice, then it will sometimes accept those eggs because all it wants to do is lay its own eggs. In nature, there are a lot of things that would keep that from happening. There would be ecological factors that would keep separation between these species. However, this wasp does have a few non-target effects. However, most stink bugs are regarded as pests, plant pests, although there are a few that are known as they're either rare or they're predatory. And so those are the ones we really have to worry about. Non-target effects on.
Yeah, because you never know when you're introducing an insect from outside, you know, how it's going to affect other targets. I mean, or other species other than the targets that you have.
But we think that this biological control is the best possible solution to this problem, because the main agricultural response to brown marmorated stink bug is a massive increase in insecticide use. And that is causing secondary problems. So we talked earlier about integrated pest management. And we don't like to use these broad-spectrum materials, which are the only ones that are effective on brown marmorated stink bug, because they kill beneficial insects as well. And so now we're getting problems with mites and aphids and things that are normally kept in check by their natural enemies. And so it's an unsustainable strategy, but that's all they had at the time when the stink bug really started taking off. Obviously, it's impossible to manage in natural areas and in urban areas, and especially where agricultural areas intersect those habitats is where you have massive problems with the stink bug, because they can just move back and forth at their will. So we need something that will work in all of those environments, and this wasp can do that. It could be active in the urban environment, so it could benefit homeowners, and it could be active in natural environments, and that could benefit native stink bug conservation and in the agricultural areas as well. So,
is there any indication that this wasp could displace other native parasitoid wasps?
I don't think it will. It definitely prefers brown marmorated stink bug, and right now brown marmorated stink bug maybe is the one that's displacing native stink bugs.
Okay.
So
it definitely would be a benefit. And it sounds like a similar insect that was introduced is the tamarisk beetle, very particular to that host, and the populations rise and ebb depending on how much tamarisk is available for it to take care of.
So that's another example of classical biological control. We call that when a natural enemy is imported. And there are other great examples with stink bugs, with egg parasitoids, such as southern green stink bug, which was it made it to Hawaii, and it was a major pest on a number of crops there. And a small parasitoid wasp was introduced, and it brought it under control, and it's no longer a problem for them. Mm. The thing I wanted to mention to you is while we're doing all this testing in quarantine facilities, we're also going out and looking to see what might be attacking the stink bug eggs in nature. And last fall, they found Trisulcus japonicus, the same species that was in quarantine, was found in the wild in Maryland.
Oh, it was already here.
It made it here on its own. So perhaps this is the best possible outcome in that we can watch what happens, and it's just a natural following of this parasitoid to the U.S. We call that adventive. And they've done genetic work to prove that it is not related. It's a different population from the one that we have in our quarantine facilities. Now, just this last season in 2015, the wasp was recovered in the site that it was found in 2014 in Maryland, but it was also found in a couple places in Virginia. So it's more widespread than we thought. And we also found it on the West Coast last season.
So is it native? Or has it just followed a different population that followed it over?
Yeah, it's followed its host.
Interesting. It's really interesting.
So we're not sure exactly what's going to happen in a regulatory sense. Normally, we would have to petition to APHIS PPQ. They're the regulatory agency that will give permits to make a release of an exotic organism if they feel that it's justified. But we would have to prove that it is justified to them. But now here we have an interesting situation where we have this wasp that is in quarantine, but it's also in the field. So I think they're still going to regulate it as a quarantine insect for now, and we'll just see how rapidly it spreads. It might be more widespread than we know because it's really difficult to detect these things. They're just tiny little wasps, and when we're doing surveys for these egg parasitoids, we're taking eggs that we have produced from our colonies of brown marmorated stink bug in the laboratory, and we actually place those out in the field so we know where the eggs are, and then we come back and pick them up and try to rear parasites out of those eggs.
Where they are attracted to the eggs, these parasitoid wasps, is there something that can be taken? Is there some... How do they know where to find the eggs, and can that be turned around and used against the stink bug itself?
Oh, that's a really great question, because these little egg parasitoids are known to be very receptive to chemicals that are given off by the stink bugs. So some of them will actually follow the female around and just wait for her to lay eggs so that they can, and sometimes they'll even ride the female. And I think a lot of it is probably habitat association. So brown marmorated stink bug is a tree-loving species, and I think these wasps are also foraging in trees. That's a ecological factor that helps them find their host. But also there are these molecules on the surface of the insect that they respond to. So they can definitely tell where a stink bug has walked. And so perhaps in the future, that might be something we could exploit.
Or maybe they develop a pheromone attractant that would then call them into a trap of some type.
Well, we have worked extensively on pheromones for brown marmorated stink bug, and that has been one of our breakthroughs in that in the last 2 years that the brown marmorated stink bug aggregation pheromone has been described And we have been able to incorporate that into a lure, and now it's been commercialized. So there are companies that are going to be producing the pheromones.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Nick Wyman is Oregon State University's Extension Orchard Crop Specialist and is the leading Western expert on brown marmorated stink bug. He was recently in Utah as part of the Utah State University Biology Department's seminar series. I'm reading from a Utah pest fact sheet from Utah State University Extension. And that was one of the things it talked about, was that the stink bug releases a pheromone that attracts other adults to congregate.
It does.
And so I'm like thinking, okay, well, if you can release that and get them all to come on in. I mean, is it saying, is that pheromone being used to say, I found some food here, come and check it out? Is that what's going on?
Yes, it's an aggregation pheromone, and it's actually produced by older males, and it attracts females, other males. It even attracts nymphs.
Hmm.
And so there's a couple of ways that that can be really useful in integrated pest management. One way is in traps, because that could give you, if we can make rules that are related to management. So if you're getting X number of stink bugs in your trap per day, then this is the time that you need to do some management. Go spray. Or we're also looking at the possibility of doing attract and kill type of strategies. And this has been proven to work pretty well in the Mid-Atlantic region, where they have taken a small section of, say, an apple orchard, and they hang a bunch of pheromone dispensers in one section of the orchard. And that attracts all the BMSB that are nearby to that spot. And it also increases the retention time, the time that they'll hang out in that spot. And then you can come through and just target that one area with your insecticide. And this saves, this has the benefit of making a really targeted action. So you're not spraying the chemical. It's not getting on the fruit. You're not worried about the maximum residue levels that are so important for any kind of fruit that's going to be exported. A lot of countries, they test our fruit very stringently for any type of insecticide residue. You're also conserving your beneficial insects mm-hmm. in the orchard. And so there are a number of benefits to that strategy that it seems to work.
Is that something that could be used in a home orchard, or do you need enough? I know there's some pheromone traps that you need to have a larger area to work with.
That's definitely true. There are a lot of... there's a lot of money being made on this insect right now, and a lot of companies are targeting homeowners with their products, and they're marketing their products as management. But actually, they've shown that a lot of people are being misled. So they buy these traps, and they put them right in their garden. And there's been a study that's come out now that says if you do that, you're going to increase your probability of getting damage on your crops in your backyard than if you had done nothing at all.
Because you're attracting more into there. Okay,
exactly.
I get it.
So not only are you spending money on something you don't need, but you're also causing extra damage to your backyard.
So right now, don't buy pheromone traps for your home, yard, or garden.
Well, not necessarily, but put them away from the crops that you're trying to protect. Don't put them in the crops you're trying to protect.
Okay.
Keep them as far away from that as possible.
Now, where they're attracted in the fall to finding protection, is that also something that could be used maybe in connection with the pheromone trap?
The problem with that is once they start, they make this switch where they start all flying to the homes at the same time. They no longer respond to the pheromone at that point. Mm. And we don't understand the cues that are causing them to pick certain houses over others. Although we're getting a little further along.
Like maybe color?
Color, type of sighting, aspect, elevation, all these things probably weigh in.
But there's no one thing that says enter here, you know,
yeah.
to attract them in.
Okay. And there might be more other chemical or vibrational signals that we don't really understand yet with that aspect of their biology. But over the last couple of years, they've been doing surveys out of the East Coast, and they try to make contact with homeowners that are having the nuisance issues, and they ask them questions like, what color is your house painted? What is your siding made out of? And that sort of thing.
I was just also reading some information here. It says, while a number of insecticides initially disabled the brown marmorated stink bug. The effect was temporary, and a high percentage of the population recovered and returned to feeding.
Yeah.
So
that's they're really
difficult.
Hard to kill. That's a big problem.
They sound like squash bugs.
They're similar to squash bugs, yeah.
So, I mean, unless I'm actually out there with hand picking is what I usually do with my own squash bugs.
Yeah.
But the populations of these, I've seen photos from the website that shows homeowners sweeping them off the front porch.
Yeah, absolutely. And homeowners come to me all the time and they want to know what they can do. And really, I think what you just mentioned, cultural controls, either picking them off by hand. People have made long attachments for like shop vacs, and you can put if you have a shop vac, you can put a couple inches of soapy water in the bottom, and that's a good way to kill them. Otherwise, if you vacuum them up, they're just all alive inside the vacuum bag, so you have to deal with that too. But making long extensions so they can get the eaves of their house, and then we recommend sealing off any cracks and.
Which is good for keeping your house warm anyway. Those cracks should be sealed in.
It is, but it's hard on an older house,
yeah.
And that's not a very satisfying recommendation for people. They want something. But I tell them if you spray at your house, what are you really affecting? Because a lot of the populations will be up high in the treetops, and, you're not going to be able to make a dent in the population you might temporarily relieve your situation, but it's going to recur.
So I'm grasping at a straw of hope here. Does elevation affect seem to affect them much?
Actually, they've been, if you look at records from China, they're found at elevations up to about 12,000 feet.
Dang. Okay, there goes that hope.
So I've been interested in that as well, and it seems that they don't mind high elevation at all. And we have a situation in our valley where
this is in the Willamette,
Willamette Valley. Yeah, most of the wine grapes are grown on hills, and then the vineyards like to have their tasting room at the top of the hill, of course. Well, the stink bugs really like to go uphill in the fall, and that's where the biggest aggregations are. And so people are up there tasting their wine, and these bugs are flying in their hair, and it's really not a good situation. So.
Well, and if they have attacked the grapes themselves, there's not only can it cause the grape to shrivel, but I was reading about the chemical that they release in the stink part of it contaminates the batch.
Yeah, it can. Well, that's something that we're worried about, and especially our signature wine in the Willamette Valley is Pinot Noir. And that's a very tight grape cluster. And grapes tend to be the last crop harvested in our valley. And so the stink bugs, some of the later bugs, are looking for anything to feed on because most of everything has been harvested. It's getting very dry at that time of year. And so they find the grapes. And they're starting to enter. It's getting late in the season. They're starting to look for overwintering sites. And they like to wedge themselves in between the grapes. And so you could harvest a cluster and never know that there are stink bugs inside of it. So that was the real issue that we were worried about. They're going to get incorporated into the wine production process and contaminate the wine. And there are two main chemicals that show up in the wine from the stink bugs because we have simulated this. We collect the stink bugs and we put them in with the wine grapes and we do the full Pinot Noir processing, and then we have people taste it and see how they respond. And it's really interesting because the two main compounds resemble cilantro in the flavor.
Interesting.
And people have a really polarized reaction to cilantro.
Either they love it or they think it tastes like soap.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They hate it.
Yeah.
And so some people can detect the most minute amount in the wine. Others don't seem to notice or they think it tastes good. So it's really interesting. We thought it would be overwhelmingly a negative response, but it turns out that's not the case. So some of the population doesn't seem to mind the taint compounds at all.
You're going to have a label that contains stink bug.
Yeah.
I'm going to have that. But it sounds like you're on the front line and whatever you're dealing with there is eventually moving here. I mean, the stink bug has been noted in along the Wasatch Front. Here in Utah, and I'm sure it's spreading elsewhere.
Yeah.
So.
and just
be watching what you're doing.
Coming up here, seeing some of the orchards that are really close to urban areas, mm-hmm. that's just prime stink bug interaction zone right there.
Well, thank you very much for coming
sure.
in, Nick.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Nick Wyman is Oregon State University's Extension Orchard Crop Specialist and is the leading Western expert on brown marmorated stink bug. He was recently in Utah as part of the Utah State University Biology Department's seminar series. You can get more information about the brown marmorated stink bug right now at the Zesty Garden website. Just go to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and drop down to Zesty Garden. In our gardening calendar, the Cash Master Gardeners present every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. February through May, Gardening in a Changing Climate. And their next lecture is by Michael Peep, Native Plants for Pollinators and Hummingbird Gardens, with poetry by Logan City Poet Laureate Star Colebrook. It's at the Wildlife Learning Center at the Willow Park Zoo from 6 to 7 p.m. February 3rd. And in Cache County, their next gardening class is Seed Selection and Planning Your Garden, February 19th at the Cache County Building Multipurpose Room, 6 to 8 p.m. The cost is free, but you do need to pre-register, so call 752-6263. And if you have an item for our Zesty Garden calendar, email it to me at zestygarden@gmail.com.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and the next three sessions when I come to you, I'm going to be reading from a book called Onward and Upward in the Garden by Catherine S. White. I really wanted to use most of the introduction by E.B. White and the first chapter of Catherine's book. So it begins with his praise for his wife, who by this time has died. In its issue March 1st, 1958, under the heading Books, the New Yorker ran a critical article on garden catalogs, and it was signed Catherine S. White. Its subhead was Onward and Upward in the Garden, and it was the first of what was to become a series of 14 garden pieces extending over a period of 12 years. And I interrupt the introduction here to say I now have moved from receiving all sorts of Christmas catalogs to the move toward receiving seed catalogs. And so this resonates with me a great deal. To readers of the magazine, this first piece came as a surprise, I think a pleasant one. It was innovative in that its author, without warning or apology, plunged boldly into reviewing the books of seedsmen and nurserymen as though she were reviewing the latest novel. To the best of my knowledge, nobody had ever done this before in a magazine of general circulation. If the New Yorker's readers were surprised, imagine the condition of seedsmen and nurserymen themselves. It must have been a dream come true for them to wake up and discover that their precious catalogs and their purple prose were being examined by a critical mind in the pages of a well-regarded publication. Once having taken off, Catherine White lost no time in slipping into a critical mood. Quote, say you have a nice flower like a zinnia, she wrote. Clean cut, of interesting, positive form, with formal petals that are so neatly and cunningly put together, and with colors so subtle yet clear that they have always been the delight of the still life artist. Then look at the W. Attlee Burpee and the Joseph Harris Company catalogs and see what the seedsmen are doing to zinnias. There followed a gentle rebuke directed at the trend toward making flowers bigger and fancier. From that moment, she was off and running. Seedsmen and hybridizers, nurserymen hung onto their hats and read about themselves, their triumphs, their failures, their conceits, their prose style, with a mixture of thanksgiving and skepticism. They were being scrutinized in public by a woman who, whatever else she was an opinionated gardener, a devoted lover of flowers and vegetables, and an addict of catalogs. She was also well along in years and had arrived at her opinions over a long period of time after much gardening. In addition to surprising thousands of New Yorker readers and dozens of seedsmen, Catherine managed to startle a third party, me, her husband. I felt both surprise and apprehension at this curious and unexpected development. I had observed my wife as a gardener, but had never thought of her as an authority on horticultural matters, although she was clearly a devotee. I did not regard her as a scientist, and I wondered whether she realized what she was getting into. But I did know that she need bow to no one in her love of flower form and her devotion to the spirit and task of gardening. Writing for her was an agonizing ordeal. Writing is hard work for almost everyone. For Catherine, it was particularly hard because she was by temperament and by profession an editor, not a writer. The exception was when she wrote letters. Her letters to friends, relatives, contributors flowed naturally from her in a clear and steady stream, a warm current of affection, concern, and eagerness to get through to the mind of the recipient. Letters were easy. How I envied her. But when she sat down to compose a magazine piece on gardening, faced with all the strictures and disciplines of formal composition and suffering the uneasiness that goes with critical expression in public print, this was something else again. Gone was the clear and steady stream. Catherine's act of composition often achieved the turbulence of a shootout. The editor in her fought the writer every inch of the way. The struggle was felt all through the house. She would write 8 or 10 words, then draw her gun and shoot them down. This made for slow and torturous going. It was simple warfare. The editor ready to nip the writer before she committed all the sins and errors the editor clearly foresaw. Occasionally, I ribbed her about the pain she inflicted on herself. "Just go ahead and write," I said. "Edit it afterwards. There's plenty of time." My advice never had any effect on her. She fought herself with vigor and conviction from the first sentence to the last, drawing blood the whole way. I worried about her health, which was not good. Luckily, she always did her homework and never started to write about anything until she knew what she was talking about. In bringing these pieces together in a book, I draw encouragement from a number of sources. First, she herself had hoped to bring out a garden book. She kept putting the matter off because she wanted to expand her existing articles and write one more piece, a reminiscence about the gardens of her childhood. Second, a number of people whose judgment I valued had urged Catherine to put her material into a book. Marianne Moore was, I think, the first one to persuade her that the New Yorker pieces should be preserved between covers. Finally, I got round to reading the articles. I discovered, to my great joy, that though they began 20 years ago, they still seemed fresh. There had been, of course, many changes in the cast of characters in the business firms, but there was a quality to her work that the years did not diminish. Her excitement at growing things, her belief in the worth of gardening, her fascination with architects who were behind the catalogs, these were timeless. She held the whole world of flowers in a warm embrace. Her pieces were intensely personal and charged with emotion. To write of Catherine simply as a gardener would be like writing of Ben Franklin simply as a printer. Gardening was indeed a part of her, but it was never her major interest, consuming all her thoughts, all her talents. She simply accepted the act of gardening as the natural thing to be occupied with in one's spare time, no matter where one was or how deeply involved in other affairs. Quote, "Although I have gardened all my life," she wrote to a reader of 1959, "I am very much of an amateur and only beginning to know a little about the many nurseries that specialize." Amateur she was, but though she lacked special knowledge and a background of science, she was bountifully endowed with strong feelings, a sure taste for what was simple and good, and the excitement and the fun that came with discovery. She had a fierce loyalty to common gifts of nature, goldenrod, pussy willows, dandelions, violets, wildflowers. As she began evaluating the catalogs of professionals, she was enchanted to find that these articulate nurserymen were not just names on a page. They were live actors on her chosen stage. They were writers, and they were a special breed of stylists of sorts, quarrelsome, opinionated, outspoken, and loaded with exact information and personal bias. They fascinated her but failed to intimidate her. And when Amos Pettingill, the sage of White Flower Farm, whose name sounded a bit too Dickinsonian for her taste, described in his catalog a French pussy willow as not the unreliable pussy willow. This was too much for my New England wife. What is unreliable, pray, about the native wild pussies? She retorted. I have found them trustworthy in every respect. I did not know at the time, and still don't know, what moved Catherine to write that first garden piece. Ever since I'd known her, she had been surrounded by seed catalogs in wintertime, by seedlings pushing up in flats in spring, and she was always arranging bouquets for our house or apartment, whether blooms came out of her own garden in Maine or out of a florist shop in town. But no writing of all of this had occurred. In 1958, her job as an editor was coming to a close, and this provided her with more time to look about, more time to think about the gardens of her life, I suspect, though the thing that started her off was a discovery that catalog makers, the men and women of her dreams, were in fact writers. Expression was the need of their souls. To an editor of Catherine's stature, a writer is a special being, as fascinating as a bright beetle. Well, here in the garden catalog, she stumbled on a whole new flock of creative people, handy substitutes for the O'Haras and the Nabokovs, the staffers of her professional life. I imagine this was what did it. She couldn't stay out of the act any longer. She began reading all of the catalog writers. Well, I will stop here and come back to E.B. White's tribute to his wife and then turn to Catherine herself. I appreciate being able to come to you and talk about some of the things that I adore. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producers Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.